In January, we return each year to our mission as a community to review it and renew it and recommit to it. And last week, we looked at the first part, inviting all, and we thought together about how we are ready not just to welcome, but to invite the people that God has placed in our lives and to own our expectations of other people and to place them before the Lord and to be ready to repent of them and receive people as they are, not as we expect or need them to be. And now we turn to the second part, the middle of our mission statement, which is really the lifeblood of this community, and that is our commitment to serving. But there is a way to serve that glorifies God, and then there is a way to serve that glorifies us. And there is a way to serve that reinforces all of the hierarchies and dynamics of the world that is passing away. And there is a way to serve that breaks through and ushers in the shalom of the kingdom of God. So we can't just make a commitment to serve. We have to make a commitment to serve like Jesus. And so we must submit and learn from him again and again. So hear these words from the Gospel of Matthew, the story that you know, but that we need to hear again. When Jesus heard what had happened, he withdrew by boat privately to a solitary place. Hearing of this, the crowds followed him on foot from the towns. And when Jesus landed and saw a large crowd, he had compassion on them and healed their sick. As evening approached, the disciples came to him and said, "This is a remote place and it's getting late. Send the crowds away so they can go to the villages and buy themselves some food." And Jesus replied, "They do not need to go away. You give them something to eat." "We have here only 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish, they answered. "Bring them here to me," he said. And he directed the people to sit down on the grass. Taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish and looking up to heaven, he gave thanks and broke the loaves. Then he gave them to the disciples and the disciples gave them to the people. They all ate and were satisfied. And the disciples picked up 12 basketfuls of broken pieces that were left over. And the number of those who ate was about 5,000, besides women and children. This week, as I was thinking and praying and meditating on this text, I read many news stories. I went down a rabbit trail learning about a restaurant called Noma that is closing. It is in Copenhagen, and it has 5 times been rated the best restaurant in the world. It has 9 Michelin stars, or however many you can optimally get. And this restaurant is really innovative. They call it the new Nordic style. It is hyper-local and eco-conscious. And if you go to Noma, you could have delicacies like grilled reindeer heart on a bed of fresh pine. You could have goat cheese curd on a bed of fermented moss. You could have saffron ice cream in a beeswax bowl or caramelized bee larvae. And this is all good and excellent fare. And you have to wait and wait to get a reservation at this place. And it has sparked something called gastro-tourism. People are taking first-class vacations and planning them around the chance to eat at these tables, where a tasting menu will cost you $500 minimum, and that does not include alcohol, which I personally would need were I going to eat grilled reindeer heart. And so this restaurant has closed, and it is a big deal in the gourmet dining world. And chefs are in mourning because the reason they closed is it's just unsustainable. They cannot make a profit, no matter how excellent it is. And chefs are giving their responses, and one of them said, like, it's a very sad day, and what do we do? Do we just tell people not to have great experiences and just eat potatoes? So apparently this is it. You can either eat grilled reindeer heart or just be miserable and eat potatoes. What is the problem? Why is this restaurant not successful? Why is it not franchising? Well, it is built. It is highly labor intensive. They call it tweezer food because you have to put it together using tweezers because it's so precise, and is built on the labor of unpaid interns. So people all over the world compete to stage at Numa, and if you win the chance to stage, you win the chance to work there for 3 months, 19-hour days, because you're learning from this amazing genius. And as I was learning more about this restaurant, I was reading accounts of people who had interned there. One of them was a woman named Namrata Hega. She spent her 3 months staging at Numa assembling fruit leather beetles. So she would take jam and dry it into strips and then use tweezers to form it into the shape of a beetle. Aren't you glad we have screens? Don't you want to see what they look like? She would make 300 a day and they would be presented to diners. And we do have a picture. Quinn, can you put it up? It looks like that. So if you don't let your kids play with their fruit roll-ups, you're really holding them back. She had to make 300 of these every day in a kitchen where all the staff had to work in complete silence, and laughter was particularly and specifically forbidden. Her experience was absurd, but other people tell the story of being physically abused. It was an open kitchen, so instead of being punched, they were kicked because they could do that underneath the counters. People were sexually assaulted. People suffered burns and broken bones that they were not allowed to go and get treatment for. And all of these young people, both on the unpaid internships and the lower positions in the kitchen, they were all on visas. So if they complained and lost their jobs, they would be kicked out of the country. People were working at this world-class restaurant, and they were actually starving while they plated $1,000 meals for their guests. One chef, Kim McCullough, who worked at Numa for years, said, look, here's what you need to understand. Just fine dining, just like diamonds and ballet and other elite pursuits, has abuse built into the model. He said, everything luxe is built on somebody's back. Somebody has to pay. We heard the story that we call Jesus feeding the 5,000, but it starts with the words, when Jesus heard what had happened. So what we want to ask is, what did Jesus hear that had happened? Because on the day that this story happened, Jesus didn't set out to feed anyone. What he set out to do was find some peace in a place apart, because he had heard what happened. And what had happened was his cousin, his friend, his faithful forerunner, John the Baptist. Jesus heard what happened to him at a luxurious banquet given by King Herod, a banquet that is as opulent and oppressive as any that has been given before or since. See, when you are king, when you are on top, you only stay king, you only stay on top for as long as you perform. You have to continually meet and exceed expectations. You have to show that you are elite, that you are powerful, that you are limitless. And if you show your weakness, if you slip, someone will come for you. And if somebody tries to come for you, you better make an example out of them. See, Herod was the dog who had caught the car. He had found himself king of Judea under the providence of Rome. So he had all of this power and all of this luxury, but he had to keep it. and you keep your power by proving that you have it. And one way that you prove that you have it is by throwing these luxurious, wildly luxurious state dinner with the power to break all customs. And what happened at that dinner that Jesus heard about is a long story, but part of it is King Herod wanted to show his power, maintain his power, prove his power. And there was a young girl who was dancing for him. And this young girl pleased Herod. This young girl was his wife's daughter, also his niece. This is why we're careful when we talk about biblical marriage. And Herod flexed his power when she danced for him and pleased him, and he said, I will give you anything you ask for, up to half of my crown. And prompted by her mother, she asked for the head of John the Baptist. So Herod, in order to keep being Herod, in order to keep living this powerful, elite, luxurious life, in order to show that he had the power to do whatever he wanted, he had to give her what she asked for then and there, even though he did not want to. And people all over Judea the next day heard the story of the amazing dinner that some were privileged to attend. The story of the food, the story of the surroundings, the story of the dancing, and the grand finale when King Herod presented his niece slash stepdaughter Salome, John the Baptist's head on a platter. This is how broken and sinful people use power. This is how broken and sinful people seek pleasure. This is how broken and sinful people consume one another. There is another way. And Jesus shows it to us. Jesus had heard what had happened to John. Jesus had heard about the vicious, meaningless savagery of his death. And Jesus tried to slip away by boat because he knew that John was only walking ahead of him, making the path straight on the same road that he was going to walk. All those prayers that he prayed in the Garden of Gethsemane, those weren't the first time he lifted them up. Jesus knew where he was headed. So he slipped away to be alone. But the people heard, and in their desperation, they figured out where he was going. So by the time he got there, they were already assembled, a crowd waiting for him with their pain, with their sick loved ones, with their demons, with their need. And Jesus's own pain and love heightened his awareness of theirs. So he got out of the boat, and together with his disciples, who had already received his authority and power to heal and drive out evil spirits, they began to minister to the people. And they were teaching and praying and healing and delivering and miraculously restoring the crowd. And the evening came, and the disciples came to Jesus and said, these people are hungry, and we're in the middle of nowhere, and thanks to us, they're healthy and healed, so send them away. They can go to the villages and buy themselves some food. The disciples believe that they have reached the end of their responsibility. We fixed them. Now they can feed themselves. We've done our part. The rest is up to them. Send them away. Send them their hunger away. And Jesus says they don't need to go away. You give them something to eat. And the disciples, again, quite reasonably say, we only have 5 loaves and 2 fishes. And famously, there are 12 of us, plus you. That's 13. We don't even have enough for ourselves. Now you want us to feed them? And Jesus said, bring what you have here to me. Bring what you do have here to me. So they do. And he invites the people to sit down, not at elaborately staged tables, but on the grass. And he takes what his disciples, his followers, have given him, and he looks up to heaven, and he gives thanks to God, and he breaks the loaves. And then he gives to the disciples the broken pieces, and the disciples serve the people, and everyone eats and eats and eats and eats until they are satisfied. And there was more than enough. There was an abundance. And when you hear this story, I want you to hear echoes of the past and echoes of the present. I want you to hear echoes of another time when God's people were huddled in the wilderness, overwhelmed in a strange place where they could not provide for themselves. And instead of sending them out or back, God rained down the bread of heaven on them, a miracle that was unrecognizable. And in the wilderness days, in unexpected and unrecognizable ways, God provides more than enough and abundance. It's who God is. And in this moment, I want you to hear echoes of the future, of a day when Jesus sat at tables with his disciples, a day he knew was coming, and with them he was celebrating the memorial meal of the Passover, remembering the time that God had delivered their ancestors from slavery into liberation and a land of abundance. And after the worship service was over, after they thought the ritual was through, after they thought they'd come to the end of the story, Jesus took leftovers from the meal on the table. One loaf of bread. And he lifted it up and he gave thanks to God and he broke it and said to them, "This is my body broken for you. Through me, abundant salvation for all." I want you to look at the story and I want you to look at our world and I want you to see there are two ways and two kinds of tables and two ways of seeking satisfaction. There's the way of Herod, which is the way of Noma, which is the way of luxury, a superior elite feasting on the fruit of the misery of their siblings, trying and failing endlessly to satisfy their souls. And then there's the way of Jesus, a way that looks like brokenness and is abundance, a way that an uninvited crowd can sit down on the grass and out of reluctantly given meager brokenness comes an abundant, miraculous feast. Unreplicatable excellence. See, at that Noma table, at Herod table, it's wildly imaginative. It is limitless. And people say the artistry lies in making cuisine, making sustenance out of rare and unusual and unimaginable food. And it is worth it. Whoever has to suffer, it is worth it to support genius with that kind of vision, to make that come to life. And I guess if that's what you find beautiful, then okay. But the meal that Jesus created that day is a vision more glorious. And the glory of Jesus' meal is not about the rarity of the food. It's just ordinary bread. It's just scrawny fish. It's just stuff that we all have lying around. But the beauty lies in this line. This is the foretaste of heaven. Here's the line. All ate until they were satisfied. For us, with eyes to see, the meal that tastes best is a meal where all eat until they're satisfied. Friends, you got to decide which meal inspires you more, which vision you want to devote your life to. What is excellent in your sight? Herod's table, elite and exclusive, but produced by human misery. Will you believe the lies of our culture that says it's either fruit beetles in Copenhagen or potatoes in misery? Will you scramble to get a limited seat at that table? Will you faithfully participate in a system that upholds that kind of scarcity and misery? Or will you decide that Jesus's table is the true feast? Jesus' table that sometimes isn't even a table at all because it occurs in wild places where people know that they can't provide for themselves, but still they're seeking what satisfies their souls and they realize that the only thing they need is their need. Their need qualifies them to receive lavish, unearned abundance. If you're drawn to Jesus' table, then you come to him and you seek to be his disciple, his follower. If you're drawn to Jesus' table, then you're invited to it not only to receive, but also to serve. And like the first disciples, we're going to learn by doing. We are not disqualified by our limits and our misunderstandings. And with Jesus, we find that it is better to serve than to be served. We find that there's a way to serve with Jesus. Because you got to understand, Herod was setting places or causing places to be set for people as well. But ours is not the way of Herod. Herod provided places for people to show them his power. And Herod's table was transactional. I invite you to my table. Now you owe me. Now I'm owed your loyalty. If you betray me, if you displease me, you're never coming back to this table. A lot of churches set that kind of table too. Jesus doesn't set that kind of table, so we can't either. You have to notice that the people in the crowd did not even know what had happened. Jesus didn't take credit. Jesus didn't take a bow. Everybody in that crowd who received did not even know the source of their sustenance. Jesus fed them because they were hungry. He didn't require or expect anything in return from them. It's got to be like that for us. And no one was excluded from Jesus's feast. And the measure of that is when Jesus sat down at the Last Supper, he did not even exclude Judas. If we serve like Herod, we will set tables where we have the power to pick and choose. And we will include those who amuse us and those we think are useful to us and those who can repay us or at least validate us. But if we serve like Jesus, the only qualification will be hunger. The only requirement will be need. The other thing I want us to notice from this story is that Herod served out of his excess, out of his abundance, and out of his power. And Jesus called his disciples to serve out of their lack, out of their need, and out of their powerlessness. Jesus calls us to serve with what we have, not with what we don't have. Jesus calls us to serve even and especially when what we have is not enough. A lot of us are genuinely waiting to serve. We are waiting for the day when we are confident that we will have enough for everyone. We are waiting for the day when we are confident that we know enough and no one will ask a question or present a need that we cannot answer. We are waiting to serve on a day when we are sure that we will be successful. But if you wait until that day, you'll wait a long time. And when you finally decide that day has come, you will be glorifying yourself. The disciples thought it wasn't their problem because they didn't have enough for everybody. And they thought that since they didn't have enough for everybody, they didn't have enough for anybody. But the disciples of Jesus then and now are called to give what we have, not what we don't have. Jesus isn't asking us to be more than we are. Jesus is asking us and inviting us to start now. Jesus isn't expecting us to do more than is possible or to give more than we have. But Jesus is inviting us to stop holding back our gifts, to stop holding back our offerings because we think they aren't valuable, because we think they aren't good enough or grand enough. What the disciples had to offer was more than enough to be filled with the glory of God. And the same is true today for us. And the last thing that I need us to see in the story as a community committed to serving, the last thing I need us to see in this story is what the incarnation should teach us if we only have eyes to see. God took on flesh, put on a human body to show us the sacredness of human bodies. In the kingdom of heaven, which is among us, there is no separation between body and soul. The disciples thought they were there for soul work, and they had a very specific and limited idea of what that was. And then they wanted to send the people away to take care of their bodies for themselves. But Jesus said, no, bodies are not less than spirits. The needs of the body are not less than the needs of the soul. To be hungry, to be unhoused, to be imprisoned, to suffer injustice, these are spiritual traumas that need to be healed. and to be deaf to the cries of the suffering, to be blind to the hungry, to profit from injustice, to feast on misery. These are spiritual traumas as well, and they are need to be healed. Jesus came to heal us, body and soul. Friends, on this day, we celebrate on this weekend the life of a man who understood that what happens to people's bodies happens to people's souls. We are here to honor a man who understood that some systems, some customs, some laws must be disrupted and overturned, even if it costs us our lives. And we are here today because God glorifies God's kingdom in the broken, inadequate, weak gifts of ordinary people who turn to Christ just like us. God is the same yesterday, today, tomorrow, and on that eternal day.